Well, I am normal is perhaps not the right word. Fortunately, my breath cannot harm Justine. Even weakened as she is, she remains stronger than any ordinary woman. My touch would burn her skin, but I will wear gloves.
Then we shall be fielding three teams, as it were, said Holmes. Miss Moreau, Miss Hyde, and Watson shall go to Whitechapel. Miss Jekyll and Mrs. Poole shall accompany me to Purfleet, and you, Miss Rappaccini, shall stay here with Miss Frankenstein.
Catherine will need to be in disguise, said Mary. She can't go to the Magdalen Society looking like that. She needs to look like, well, a fallen woman.
They all looked at Catherine. This morning she was wearing one of Mary's day dresses, a brown tartan with a pleated collar. Her hair was pulled back into a chignon at the nape of her neck. Aside from her yellow eyes and the tracery of scars, she looked like a schoolmistress.
"You're never going to fool old Ma Raymond dressed like that," said Diana. "You need to look fancy with flounces and furbelows, but cheap, and you need paint."
"Flounces and furbelows? As though for a woman of the streets! How in the world could Mary supply those?" There was really only one possibility.
"Come up to my mother's room," she said. "I may have something."
Catherine and Diana followed her up the stairs, while Holmes and Watson waited below, and Mrs. Poole assured them that the girls would be back down in a moment, that matters of dress took time. In Mrs. Jekyll's wardrobe, Mary found an old tea gown of her mother's, at least 10 years out of date. It was the only thing she could think of that was fancy enough for Catherine to wear.
"It doesn't quite fit," said Catherine. "A former mistress of mine could have given it to me before I was dismissed and forced to make my living on the streets, like Pauline Delacroix. That's what I'll tell Mrs. Raymond."
"She still needs paint and her hair done," said Diana.
"Well, I don't know where to buy paint. A theatrical shop of some sort?" said Mary impatiently. "What was she, a department store?"
"No, you need it put on by someone who knows how. Like Kate Brighteyes."
"Kate is the one who knew Molly Keane," said Catherine.
She turned around in front of the mirror, examining herself from all angles. For a moment, Mary felt a pang of guilt. It was, after all, her mother's gown, even though it had not been worn for many years. But surely her mother had wanted her to find out about the Société des Alchimistes, or why had she saved the letters in the portfolio? That information had been left for Mary, she was sure of it.
"Yes, that's Kate," said Mary.
"I suppose you could go to the Bells and ask for her."
"Ha! You see, I do come up with clever ideas," said Diana.
"All right, that was clever," said Mary.
"But is it absolutely necessary for you to dress like that? Catherine needs to be in disguise. You don't."
While Mary had been searching for her mother's tea gown and helping Catherine put it on, Diana had once again changed into boys' clothes. Mary could not help wishing that she looked more, well, respectable.
"Catherine said I might have to climb, and it's easier climbing as a boy."
Diana put her hands in her trouser pockets. It was obvious that she was not going to change, nohow.
Diana.
"Respectable my arse. Why would anyone want to wear girls' clothes unless they had to? If you walk around the city as a boy, people don't notice you or ask what you're doing all by yourself, my pretty."
Mary. "Cat, you said you would edit out inappropriate language." Catherine.
"I think my arse is perfectly appropriate in this context, and I agree with Diana."
Mary was annoyed, sitting in the railway carriage on the way to Purfleet. She had wanted to discuss the case with Mr. Holmes, and instead he was engaged in a discussion with Mrs. Poole on the minutiae of housekeeping, on how various stains set and were to be gotten out, the schedules of tradespeople and their deliveries. He seemed fascinated by these domestic details.
"You never know when the most trivial information might help solve a case," he said.
I myself, Mrs. Poole, have written a monograph on the soils around London. Did you know, for example, that there is a distinct difference between the soils of Spitalfields and Shoreditch?
Is there really, sir?
I would not have thought it, said Mrs. Poole, and received a disquisition on types of cigarette ash that seemed to fascinate her. The asylum looked just as Mary remembered, with its brick wall and tall iron gates, over which she could see the tops of the trees. But this time there was no Joe Abernathy to let them in.
No, sir, said the attendant who came to answer the bell when Holmes asked his whereabouts. He was sacked, along with Dr. Balfour and a whole lot of others on account of Renfield escaping. Dr. Seward was right angry about it. He was in Vienna, or some such place, and took a train back as soon as he heard about the murders. He arrived yesterday morning and sent everyone who had to do with Renfield packing. He's the one you'll have to see if you want information. He's with another gentleman right now. I just let him in, a gentleman from London. But I'll ask if you can talk to him. What name should I give?
Well, that explains why Dr. Balfour didn't respond to my telegram, Holmes whispered to Mary. They waited in the front hall while the attendant confirmed that Dr. Seward would see Mr. Holmes briefly, although he did not have much time, they were warned. Then they were shown up the stairs to the director's office. As they came to the door, it opened, and a man with a shock of grey hair stepped out. He seemed agitated and almost ran into Holmes.
"Pardon me," he said, then nodded to them curtly.
This office was very different from Dr. Balfour's. It had obviously been used for a long time, but was considerably neater. The shelves were filled with books, and there were documents and letters stacked on the desk. Mary wondered if the letter from Professor Van Helsing had been missed.
"Mr. Holmes, to what do I owe the pleasure of this visit?"
said the man behind the desk, sounding as though it was not a pleasure at all. He had a grim official look about him, and was clearly impatient for them to be gone again.
"Dr. Seward, I presume," said Holmes. "Indeed. I can spare you 15 minutes, but I'm sure you'll understand that we're very busy this morning. You know, I'm sure, that the madman Renfield has escaped from police custody. We don't know if he intends to return here. I've asked Inspector Lestrade to send us policemen, but they have not yet arrived. Oh, damn!"
Mary jumped. But this last exclamation was not meant for them. Seward sprang up and grabbed a furled umbrella that had been leaning against the side of his desk. Then he strode to his office door, opened it, and shouted down the hall,
"Sam! Sam! Mr. Prendick left his umbrella!"
Sam must have come back to retrieve it, because Dr. Seward stepped out into the hallway, and Mary heard,
"Can you run and give it to him before he catches the train?" "Yes, thank you. That will be all for now. I'll ring for you when you can let Mr. Holmes out."
Prendick? She would have to tell Catherine as soon as possible. How would Catherine feel, knowing that the man who had left her to die was not only alive, but here in London?
"My apologies," he said, coming back into the office. "Particularly to the ladies."
He looked at Mary and Mrs. Poole, clearly wondering who the devil they were and why they had come to see him. Before Holmes could speak, Mary hastily said, "That's quite all right, Dr. Seward. I'm Miss Jenks of the Christian Women's Missionary Society, and this is my associate, Mrs. Poole. Our society is concerned with saving women who have fallen into sin. Several of the women who were so brutally murdered were on our rolls as having received assistance from our society. And our patroness, whose name I may not mention, but who is connected with the royal family, insisted that we be allowed to accompany Mr. Holmes. I hope our presence will not interfere with your conversation in any way. We are here simply to observe, and will be as quiet as church mice."
"Miss Jenks and Mrs. Poole were, of course, most welcome to accompany me," said Holmes. "Cum mulieribus non est disputandum, as Cicero says."
"I see," said Seward. His mouth twitched, and he looked at Holmes with sympathy.
"Now, tell me what you wish to know about Renfield."
"Diana,
Translation, please, for those of us who didn't go to Oxford.
Justine. There is no arguing with women, and I don't believe Cicero ever said such a thing.
Anything you can tell me, said Holmes. His history, his past associations. Did he ever receive visitors? Miss Jenks, do you have paper and a pencil? Perhaps you could make yourself useful and take some notes.
Of course, Mr. Holmes, said Mary.
Did she have those things? A pencil, yes. But paper?
Silently, Mrs. Poole opened her capacious handbag, pulled out a pad of paper, and handed it to Mary. For the first time, she felt grateful for Mrs. Poole's presence, then guilty for not having appreciated it before. She flipped past pages of marketing lists.
Is there anything in particular you would like me to note down?
Anything of interest that could bear on this investigation. You're an observant young woman, I'm sure.
Holmes said this courteously, carelessly, as though simply giving her something to do. Mary looked around the office without seeming to. What did he want her to notice? Or was she mistaken? And did he want her simply to write down what Dr. Seward had to say? But Seward could or would tell them almost nothing. Renfield has once been, believe it or not, considering his present state, a gentleman, a man of business in the city. His business had begun to fail, and the strain of it had been too much for him. Eventually he had developed the habits that marked his madness. He had neither wife nor children, and his business partners, fearing for his safety, had him committed to Purfleet Asylum. His fees were paid quarterly by the business. He had never in all the years he had been in the asylum received visitors. That was all Seward knew.
Of course he came here under my predecessor. I myself am relatively new here. I became director only 5 years ago, whereas some of the patients have been here 20 years. Which is why this incident... Well, I've been called before the Board of Trustees, so you can understand why I'm so eager, Mr. Holmes, to have Renfield caught and returned to us. I'm afraid there's nothing more I can tell you. Renfield left no papers or other effects, except some notebooks containing what he called his accounts. Nothing but numbers. I'll have Sam show them to you before you leave.
When he bid them farewell, he added,
I hope you and Inspector Lestrade will do your utmost to catch him, Mr. Holmes. My professional career depends on his return. And the best of luck to you, Miss Jenks, in your good work. What did you say your organization was called again? Perhaps I could send a donation.
What in the world had she called it? Mary hesitated for a moment.
Thank you, indeed, sir, said Mrs. Poole. These young women come to us blackened by sin, but by prayer and good works they are washed as white as lambs of God. By which I mean their souls, sir. God may hate the sin, but he loves the sinner. And we hope to see these young women seated at the right hand of the Father when their souls are washed clean. Also we give them hot soup. Hot soup and prayer, sir, we'll do it every time. Perhaps we can send you some tracts and a request for a subscription.
Yes, yes, quite, said Seward hastily. Allow me to show you out. I'm sure you must wish to be in London again as quickly as possible to continue your good works.
Before they left, Sam showed them Renfield's notebooks, but Seward had been right. They contained nothing but rows of numbers, presumably representing the flies he had caught and ingested. Nothing to help them in their investigation. After they had walked through the front gates of the asylum, which clanged shut behind them, Mary pulled the pad of paper on which she had been writing out of her purse. She had stuffed it in there when they left Dr. Seward's office, but her purse was not as capacious as Mrs. Poole's. She had been worried it might not come out again.
Is this what you wanted? She asked.
Ah, I wondered if you would see it, said Holmes. Bravo, Miss Jenks. I memorized the name and the location of the hotel in Soho, but it's useful to have your written confirmation. And how clever of you to transcribe the letter as well.
Whatever are you going on about?
asked Mrs. Poole. Mary showed her the notebook. On a sheet of paper she had written, "Stationery headed Dearborn Hotel, Soho. Address too small to make out. My dear John, I will come as soon as I can, but I know no more about these murders than you do. Why should I? Surely you and Van Helsing don't suspect me of being involved in any way. That is absurd and unjust of you. Let me know when you arrive and I will come to Purfleet, but I swear to you that I know nothing whatsoever. Edward." "It was upside down, but not too difficult to make out, except for the address," said Mary. "Although all these scientific men seem to have atrocious handwriting. My governess, Miss Murray, would have made them write out a section of Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey. That's what she made me do, to correct my hand. This must be the Edward Prendick mentioned in Catherine's story and Professor Van Helsing's letter?"
"Certainly," said Holmes. "I don't know if you saw his face as we passed, Miss Jekyll, but his hair was not grey from age. Whatever he has endured, it has marked him forever."
No, she had not noticed Prendick's face. Mary felt a sense of consternation. She simply must become more observant, like Mr. Holmes.
"I believe our next course of action is to return to London and pay a visit to Mr. Prendick," Holmes added. "Clearly Dr. Seward thought he was involved with the murders in some way, and Miss Moreau indicated that he knew how to make the beast men you encountered yesterday. If we had been more precipitous, we might have run into him casually on the train. But that is his train departing now, and we are not on it."
Sure enough, Mary could hear the train whistle, and there was a line of white smoke against the sky across the marshes that separated the asylum from the train station. "If we can't catch Mr. Prendick anyway, I think there's one more line of investigation here in Purfleet," she said. "What about Joe Abernathy? He's known Renfield longer than Dr. Seward, and he was there when Renfield escaped. He must live somewhere in the village."
"Also, he has just lost his position and will not be feeling particularly loyal to Dr. Seward," said Holmes. "An excellent suggestion, Miss Jekyll. And I must say, that was masterfully done, Mrs. Poole."
"Ah, well, thank you, sir," said Mrs. Poole, looking embarrassed. "I was in amateur theatricals when I was a girl. We used to have a sort of club just among the servants in Park Terrace. Used to call ourselves the Park Terrace Players, and put on Shakespeare as well as popular plays like The Scottish Lass and Maid of the Moors. I was Titania once."
Mary tried to imagine the respectable Mrs. Poole as Titania, Queen of the Fairies, but to this imagination would not stretch.
Mrs. Poole: "I was a very good Titania, I'll have you know."
Beatrice: "I have no doubt you were, Mrs. Poole."
How to find Joe was the next question, but Holmes said,
"Always ask at the pub, Miss Jekyll. Elementary investigation, the pub always knows, and there I see the black dog, so we shall step inside."
"That she will not," said Mrs. Poole. "You may go where you like, Mr. Holmes, but I will not have her setting foot in a place where men are drinking and ogling like as not."
"Oh, for goodness sake," said Mary.
Diana was right. It was better to dress as a man. She had never before found being a woman confining, but then she had never attempted to investigate a series of murders before either. She had never attempted much of anything, and now she was finding that as soon as one began moving around in the world, doing things, one ran up against a regular list of "you shan'ts."
"Then I shall return in a moment," said Holmes, and disappeared into the dark maw of the black dog.
It was closer to a half hour before he returned, and Mary and Mrs. Poole had walked around the central square of Purfleet, looking into all the shop windows, at the hams on display at the butcher's, the buns at the baker's, the ribbons and gloves at a shop for ladies' accoutrements.
"Joe lives with his mother in one of the cottages recently built for working men, on a road called Peaceful Row," he told them.
I suppose the builders thought that name might avert strikes among the quarry workers. Miss Jekyll, should you ever find yourself in a pub, despite Mrs. Poole's care, never ask a question directly, for you will never get an answer. I bought a pint and said I had come from the asylum where I was thinking of confining a relative, but I didn't know if I wanted him in an institution and might look for a man to care for him privately. I wondered if any employees of the asylum might prefer a private situation and was told that several had lost their positions, including Joe. They were almost pressing his address on me, and I promised that I would go see him as soon as possible.
How clever of you, sir, said Mrs. Poole.
Well, thought Mary,
I would have been just as clever if I'd been allowed into the pub.
I could have told them that I had a poor mad father, or that my brother was in the asylum and Joe had been caring for him. I could have told them any number of things.
What was the use of propriety when it kept one from getting things done?
They had to pass the asylum gates again, taking care not to be seen, but no one was watching. Peaceful Row was just off the main road, a paved street with modern cottages arranged neatly on either side, each with its own small garden. Joe Abernathy's cottage was at the end of the street, before the pavement turned into a path and wandered across fields filled with clover and buttercups. Several cows looked at them curiously, then went back to tearing up mouthfuls of grass. The cottage was surrounded by a garden in which vegetables grew among the flowers. Several hens scratched in the dirt. To one side of the cottage, a woman was hanging laundry on a line.
"Pardon me," said Holmes. "Mrs. Abernathy?"
"Aye, I'm she," said the woman, wiping her hands on her apron and approaching the fence. "And who might you be, sir?"
She looked at him warily, as though he might be selling some sort of patented medicine or mechanical broom.
"I'm Sherlock Holmes, and I've come to talk to Joe," said the detective.
He waited, but if he expected her to recognize the name, he was disappointed. She merely nodded and said,
"I'll see if he's in."
She walked through the side door, then came out again a moment later.
"Aye, he says to go on in. You'll forgive me, sir. What with this lunatic escaping and then losing his position over it, he's not wanting to see many people just now. Especially not newspaper men, and you have that look about you." "I'll stay out here, I think," said Mrs. Poole. "You have a way with the linen, ma'am. I've never seen pillowcases so white. What do you bleach them in?" "Oh, well, I make my own washing powder, but it's the lavender as does it. I lay them out on lavender to dry," said Mrs. Abernathy, visibly pleased.
"There goes my vanity, Miss Jekyll," said Holmes as they walked through the garden, avoiding the hens, which did not move out of their way. "The look of a newspaper man, indeed. But our Mrs. Poole is proving invaluable. She is a mistress of the art of distraction."
The side door led directly into the kitchen, which was spotlessly clean. Joe was sitting at the table reading a newspaper. When they entered, he looked up.
"Well, if it isn't you, miss. Mother told me Mr. Holmes had some ladies with him, but I didn't expect one of them to be you. What a pleasure to see you again. I'm just reading about old Renfield's escape. You know, I lost my position over this affair. Although how they expected me to prevent it when the man can escape from a police wagon, I don't know. He must be a magician."
"Well, I don't know about that," said Holmes. "He may have been helped. That's what we've come to talk to you about, to see if Renfield had any associates."
"Associates? I don't know what kind of associates you would be meaning. He was mostly locked up in the asylum. But when he ran away, which he did regular, he could have formed associates that helped him escape."
"Dr. Seward said he was a businessman before he became mad," said Mary. "Could he have had business associates, perhaps? Anyone he knew from his life before? Did he ever receive visitors?"
"No, never a visitor. I didn't know he was a businessman.
That must be why he kept writing numbers down, as though keeping accounts. Of the flies he was eating, you know, and how much life they were giving him. Although he called them his experiments. He would go on about those experiments of his, how each fly gave him so much life and no more. He wanted to know how much life he could get out of them, and then how much if he fed them to spiders and ate the spiders, and then how much if the spiders were eaten by birds. But we never let it get past spiders, which he could catch himself. "I'll show them," he would say to me. "Someday, Joe, I'll show them my notebooks, and then they'll have to take me back. They can't deny me the secret of life." But when I asked him who would take him back and who was denying him the secret of life, whatever that might be, he would cringe and whine, saying they would kill him straight away if he told anyone. But that was all part of his madness, miss.
Yes, although there is often a method in madness, said Mary. Do you remember anything else he used to say?
No, that was about all. Just the flies and the spiders eating the flies and then the birds, and he wanted a cat. That's what he wanted most. A cat to eat the birds, and he would eat the cat, I presume, and get life from it.
Before they left, Holmes insisted on giving Joe a half-crown.
Thank you, sir, said Joe. And if I think of anything else, I'll let you know. I hope they deal with old Renfield kindly when they catch him. I don't believe he murdered those women. He was always a gentle soul, excepting to spiders and flies.
Holmes and Mary walked away from Joe's house in a thoughtful mood.
You're both awfully quiet, said Mrs. Poole,
tucking away the recipe for homemade washing powder that Mrs. Abernathy had given her.
Do you think, said Mary, looking at Holmes.
I think it's a distinct possibility, he said.
You were right. Everyone does seem to belong to this blasted society. If Renfield was once a member...
He might know some of the others, said Mary. Although if he had once been a member, surely Dr. Seward would have been aware of it. We know he's a member himself.
Ah, that Dr. Seward was lying through his teeth, said Mrs. Poole. You can always tell when people are lying. It's when they look at you too straight, as though they were angels here on earth, and indignant, as though they can't believe you would doubt them.
Perhaps, said Holmes. If he knew that Renfield was once a member of the Alchemical Society, he would certainly have reason to lie.
It was a perfect spring day, not raining, for once, and as they walked back to the train station, Mary imagined they were simply three people going for a walk in a country town. The sun shone down on the cottages and shops of Purfleet, and in the gardens she could see poppies and the tall blue spikes of larkspur. But then she remembered Molly Keane, dead on the streets of Whitechapel, lying in a pool of her own blood. It could not make her enjoy the day less, but it reminded her that there were still murders to investigate. Chapter 14. The Twisted Man. Mary wondered if the train ride back to London would be like the one that morning. Would Holmes spend it discussing domestic details with Mrs. Poole? But no. He and Mary went over the details of the case. If Renfield had not killed those women, who had? Evidence seemed to indicate that it was someone connected with the Société des Alchimistes. But whom? Dr. Seward's letter had made it clear that he had no knowledge of the murders. Indeed, he was alarmed by them. But it was also clear that there were various factions in the society. Could this be the work of a faction that opposed Seward and his friends? Who then were they? It seemed as though they were in contact with Renfield without Seward's knowledge. So on the one hand, said Mary, we have my father, Dr. Appaccini, and Dr. Moreau, who all knew each other, and who are all dead. And then we have Dr. Seward and his friend Professor Van Helsing, who knows Mr. Prendick, who knew Dr. Moreau. And then we have Renfield, and the implication that he may at one time have seen Hyde. Three different groups of people. Are they friends, enemies,
in league with one another? And who among them would be murdering women? Beatrice said it was an ancient experiment, the same process that had created Frankenstein's monster 100 years ago. Why would anyone want to recreate that?
Then there is the question of whether this is all connected to the Magdalen Society, said Holmes. Is it merely a coincidence that 4 of the murdered women had been inmates of the society? I wonder whether Miss Moreau has any information for us. Perhaps there will be a message when we return.
What about Mr. Prendick? Asked Mary. Don't we need to find him and follow him? Dearborn Hotel in Soho. It shouldn't be hard to find.
Oh, no, you don't, said Mrs. Poole. Neither of you seems to have noticed that you haven't eaten anything since breakfast. First we go back to the house. It's almost tea time. Anyway, you need to check for messages, don't you? And then you can go following whoever you please.
But when they arrived at 11 Park Terrace, there was no message. As soon as they stepped out of the cab from the station, Mrs. Poole said, "The door's open." And sure enough, the front door was almost imperceptibly open, as though it had been closed by a person who was not very careful. "Beatrice? Justine?" Mary called as soon as they entered the house. Her words echoed down the hall. There was no response. Then all 3 of them called. Even the respectable Mrs. Poole, who, as far as Mary knew, had never shouted before in her life. Mrs. Poole.
Of course I've shouted before. I'm human, aren't I?
Diana.
Scolded isn't the same as shouted.
There was no response. The house was empty. Except, of course, for the beast man lying on the floor of Justine's room, but being dead, he scarcely counted. Mary almost tripped over him when she ran upstairs in a panic to see why Beatrice, at least, wasn't answering. She screamed just a little, more in surprise than fright, when she saw him on the carpet. The sound brought Mrs. Poole and Holmes upstairs after her. She stood in the entrance to the room, looking at the dead beast man. He lay amid a tangle of bed curtains. Someone, whether a beast man or Justine, had torn them from the bed. And the rest of the room was a shambles. Chairs were overturned. The shaving stand had been knocked over. And its mirror was covered with a spiderweb of cracks. The clock and spill vase had been swept off the mantelpiece. They lay smashed into pieces on the hearth.
"Dear Lord," said Mrs. Poole.
"They put up a fight," said Mary. She did not know what else to say.
"They did indeed," said Holmes. "Look at this man's face, although man is a generous term to use for him. Judging by his hairiness and the shape and size of his teeth, he was once a bear. He seems clumsily made. I wonder..." "Well, no time for speculation now."
On his cheeks, the bear man had 2 marks, as though he had been grasped by 2 red hands. "That must have been Beatrice," said Mary. "She told us her touch could burn." Holmes walked around the room, examining the overturned furniture, the tangled curtains.
"I want to go outside and check for footprints. No, Miss Jekyll, you may not come with me."
Mary opened her mouth to protest.
"More of them may be lurking about, so, if you please."
She shut her mouth again, but was not, in fact, pleased. If there were beast men lurking about, 2 together would be safer than 1, and surely she could be of help. But Holmes was already gone. She waited impatiently as Mrs. Poole walked round the room, surveying the damage.
"Look at this clock. It came with your mother when she married your father all the way from Yorkshire. It stood on this mantel for more than 20 years, and I was always grateful, miss, that you couldn't sell it because it ran a bit slow. Well, it won't be keeping time now, that's for certain."
"Surely that's less important than Justine and Beatrice," said Mary.
"Of course it is," said Mrs. Poole reproachfully. "But we can't do anything about them at the moment, can we?
Do what you can, as my mother used to say, and leave the rest to God. Or Mr. Holmes, as the case may be.
I would never arrogate to myself the powers of the deity, Mrs. Poole, said Holmes.
He re-entered the bedroom with his long stride.
There were five of them, including our dead friend. Three wearing boots, two with feet too deformed for human footwear. All their gaits are irregular, as though they were shuffling. I saw their footprints clearly in the mud on the sidewalk, five coming and four going, although they ended at the bottom of the road, where I believe they had a carriage waiting. Going, there is a mark as of someone being hurried along and half-dragged. No clear prints, but the foot is smaller than the others. Perhaps one of the ladies was dragged and the other was carried.
Beatrice must have killed the bear man, but she couldn't have handled five, said Mary. And Justine was too sick to fight back.
I think Justine must have done some fighting too, nevertheless, said Holmes. Otherwise there wouldn't be so much damage.
We need to summon the police, said Mrs. Poole.
No, said Mary. The police would never believe us. What would we say? You need to look for a poisonous girl and a woman who is over 6 feet tall because they've been kidnapped by a bunch of beast men?
Miss Jekyll is right, said Holmes. Lestrade would laugh in our faces. We need to send Watson a message and find Prendick. All the clues indicate that Miss Rappaccini and Miss Frankenstein were kidnapped by beast men, and Prendick knows how to make beast men. You'll need to stay here, Mrs. Poole, in case the others return or try to contact us. And Miss Jekyll...
I'm not staying here, said Mary. I'm coming with you, proper or not. I want to find out what happened to Beatrice and Justine.
You go right ahead, miss, said Mrs. Poole.
Two heads are better than one, they say. I'll straighten up here.
If you see Charlie, said Holmes, send him on to Watson with this message. Miss Rappaccini and Miss Frankenstein have been kidnapped, and we've gone to find Prendick in Soho at the Dearborn Hotel. He may have simply gotten the stationery there, but hopefully he'll be staying either at the hotel or close by. Come on, Miss Jekyll. We haven't had our tea, but no rest for the wicked, as they say, or for detectives, either.
Together they set out for Soho. At the last minute, Mrs. Poole had handed Mary a tea cake, saying,
You have to eat something, miss, otherwise you'll faint. And what sort of help will you be to Mr. Holmes, then?
Mary walked quickly, the uneaten tea cake in the pocket of her mackintosh, worried about the two girls. Where were they? Would they be all right? She'd only known them for a few days, but already they felt like family, as though they belonged together.
Beatrice, as we do.
Mary,
despite our differences.
Beatrice,
or because of them.
Meanwhile, Catherine had spent that afternoon sewing. Kate Brighteyes had done wonders. At the Bells, where they found her, she had worked on Catherine's face and hair.
I have all my things here, she told them. After what happened to Molly, I can't live alone any more. I get nightmares. So I'm renting a room at the inn, though it's twice as much as my old lodgings. You're a brave one, Miss Moreau. I wouldn't go into that society knowing the girls who died had been there not for £100. There, how does that look?
Catherine looked at herself in the cracked mirror that hung in Kate's room. The powder Kate had put on her face and neck covered the scars. In the mirror she saw rouged lips and cheeks, and a great deal of hair, not all of it her own. Yes, it would do just fine. Of course, as soon as she arrived at the Magdalen Society, Mrs. Raymond had told her rather sharply to wash her face and rearrange her hair. She'd wiped off the rouge. It had done its work, which was convincing Mrs. Raymond that she was in need of salvation. But she had not touched the powder, which was the colour of her skin anyway.
It's what actresses use, Kate had told her. You're a bit darker than most of us, ain't you? But I think it will do.
With it, she looked entirely human.
She liked looking human. And then she had gone to the workroom. If you asked Catherine what she likes less than sewing, she would say being shut up in a cage in a ship's hold for weeks while that ship sails across the Pacific Ocean to a mysterious island. Or on that island, being transformed from an animal into a woman without the benefit of anesthesia. But that might be it. She would prefer eating rats on the streets of London or being chased by wolf men. Mary, must you be so melodramatic? And she is particularly bad at it. Perhaps it has to do with the fact that her hands were once paws, but she is unable to sew even a straight seam, as Sister Margaret reported to Mrs. Raymond. She's quite hopeless. I gave her a tea towel to hem, and look at it. Perhaps we can have her do something else. Mop the floors, for instance. The new girl's yellow eyes made Sister Margaret nervous. We might put her in the cleaning crew by and by, said Mrs. Raymond. But for now I want her under your supervision. There's something about her. She pondered for a moment, then shook her head. No, I can't place it, not yet. At any rate, I don't want her doing anything arduous. We don't want her to suddenly leave, do we? To return to the base luxury of her life on the streets like those other girls? Poor Sally Hayward or Anna Pettingill? We want her to understand the value of what we offer here, the comfort and safety of the Magdalen Society. And get her a work dress as soon as possible. I don't want her going around in that ridiculous get-up. Diana. How do you know what they said? It's not as though you could hear them.
Catherine. I did, actually. It was the first time I tried reconnoitering, but Mrs. Raymond was in her office. I was right outside the door and heard them. Anyway, it doesn't matter if I got the details exactly right. What matters is whether it makes for a good story.
Whatever Catherine was considering at that moment, it was not the comfort and safety of the Magdalen Society. Her thread had snapped again, which meant re-threading and making sure the new stitches continued imperceptibly from the old, while overlapping enough so that neither end would come loose.
"Why are we sewing, anyway?" she asked. "I don't see why we all have to be sewing. Aren't there other things we could be doing that would save our souls just as well?"
"Hush! Sister Margaret could return at any moment," said the girl sitting next to her.
The girl's name was Doris, and she had pimples on her cheeks. She was only 15, and rather plump. It was difficult to tell that she had ever wandered the London streets. She looked like any servant girl from Mayfair or Marylebone.
"The linens and clothes we sew are bought by charitable women who buy them to support the society."
Catherine wondered whether her crooked tea towel, the second she had hemmed that day, would help the society. She rather thought not.
"I have a friend who was here about a month ago," she said. "Her name was Molly Keane. Did you know her?"
"You knew Molly?"
said the girl to the other side of Catherine. She was thin and sallow, with dark circles under her eyes. Catherine vaguely remembered that her name was Agnes.
"Well, I never. Horrible what happened to her, wasn't it? It's a lesson on the wages of sin, as Mrs. Raymond always tells us."
"No chattering," said Sister Margaret.
They had not heard her come in, but she stood in front of them, pursing her mouth, which made it look as though she sucked limes for the fun of it.
"Idle chatter is the devil's work. Who would like to read to us from Reverend Throckmorton's sermons?"
And that's the problem right there, thought Catherine,
ignoring the voice of Agnes, droning on about how Jesus had separated the sheep from the goats, and the lesson Reverend Throckmorton had derived from that text.
"There's never any time to talk in this damned place. It's prayers and sermons and work all day long."
It had not been difficult to join the Magdalen Society. Mrs. Raymond had taken one look at her and assigned her a bed. Although she had said rather sharply, "I hope you understand that we expect all our girls to truly repent
Miss Montgomery.
Oh, I will, I promise you, Catherine had replied. You don't know how grateful I am for this opportunity, ma'am. It's rough on the streets, and after that sailor came at me with the broken bottle, I'd had enough, I can tell you. And my landlady said I wasn't paid up, so she wouldn't let me in the boarding house. And my da won't take me back. I taint all the other children, he says. All I have is the clothes on my back. I'm grateful you're willing to take me in.
Well, you just behave yourself here, Mrs. Raymond had said with a frown.
Catherine had nodded and signed in the big book, a large leather-bound volume in Mrs. Raymond's office, where girls who had come before her had written their names, or made their X's next to the names written for them. She had signed Catherine Montgomery. The first thing she would have to do was look at that book. She assumed it contained the names of all the girls who had stayed at the Magdalen Society. Catherine would see if the murdered girls were listed. And then? She wasn't sure. But whatever she did would have to wait until that night, when everyone was asleep. In the meantime, she had a seam to sew.
Diana. We were so bored waiting in the house across the street, me and Charlie. Dr. Watson didn't seem to mind. He read all the newspapers for mentions of anything unusual, he said. Once he pointed out that the animals stolen from Lord Avebury's menagerie were still missing. The search had been going on for a month, but they hadn't been found. What do we care about a bunch of animals? I asked him. But he said any missing animals could have been used to make beast men.
Catherine, at least you didn't have to sew seams and listen to Agnes read sermons. Sister Margaret had a whole book of them, by a Reverend Throckmorton, whom she had once met, and for whom I'm convinced she had a secret passion. They were about sheep and goats, and the saved and the damned, and how one would be saved and the other damned forever. He seemed to have something against goats. After several hours of listening to that, I was ready to rip her throat out.
Justine, it's not such a bad thing to learn about God. I could not have lived all those years alone if it were not for the spiritual lessons my father taught me before he died. I find it comforting to believe in a divine father who observes and knows all.
Catherine, oh, spare me. Religion is a tool some men use to control others. I saw that myself on Moreau's Island.
Diana, what Catherine said. If you had grown up in that damned society.
Beatrice.
Please, we've had these arguments before. Justine will never convince you, and you will never convince Justine. Cat, go back to your story. Our readers aren't interested in a theological discussion.
At last, the bells announced that it was time for dinner. An entire day of sitting in an unnatural position doing unnatural work, listening to nonsense. Who actually needed tea towels anyway? Or the horrible pin-tucked children's smocks the more experienced sewers were making? Not children, who would rather run around naked like animals or savages. And much healthier it would be for them too. At tea, Catherine discovered that meals at the Magdalen Society included no meat. Because vegetable matter was healthier, said Reverend Throckmorton. Have you ever heard such nonsense? She stared down at what Sister Margaret cheerfully informed her was a vegetable ragout.
You're not eating, said Agnes, who was sitting next to her. Are you quite all right?
I've decided to fast, said Catherine. Hunger will remind me to repent of my sins.
I understand, said Agnes. I felt that way myself before I found peace and forgiveness for my sins. Those will come to you in time, I promise.
Catherine looked at her thin, earnest face and wondered what she would taste like. Not much meat on those bones, unfortunately. Doris would be more appetizing. A girl across the table from her, who could not have been more than 12 or 13, looked at her curiously. But when Catherine gave her a hard stare, she looked down again at her own plate. After dinner there was a lecture, and then more prayers.
And finally the inmates of the Magdalen Society were dismissed and sent to bed.
"You're not in the dormitory," said Sister Margaret. "Follow Alice. Here's a work dress for you, which you should wear tomorrow, and a nightgown. It's been freshly laundered, so it may be damp. Dresses and undergarments are laundered once a week. Sheets once a month. If you have any questions, Alice should be able to answer them."
Alice was the girl who had been sitting across the table from Catherine, the one who had stared at her during dinner.
"It's this way," she said.
She gave Catherine a curious sidelong glance, but did not say anything further. Catherine followed her up a flight of stairs to the third floor. Here there were a number of smaller rooms. Each had been allocated to two girls who shared one bed. Besides the bed, the room had only a chest of drawers and a single wooden chair. When Catherine saw the narrow bed she would be sharing with Alice, she wondered how she would be able to sneak out at night. Perhaps Alice was a heavy sleeper.
"I could help you, miss," said Alice. "With those buttons, I mean."
There were a lot of buttons on the dress she was wearing. She had not considered how she was to undo them.
"Thank you," she said. "And you don't need to call me miss. Just Catherine."
"Yes, miss," said Alice.
She started on the buttons up the back.
"I was in service, you see, before I came down in the world. When my mistress died, there was no money left to keep servants, so we were all dismissed. It's not so easy to find a job nowadays. I swept a crossing for a while, and then a gentleman offered me money for other kinds of services, but I said no. And a kind lady, seeing as how he was importuning me, gave me a card with this address on it. It's not so bad, if you can get used to the food and sermons."
She started on the buttons on the cuffs.
"This dress now, it reminds me of one my old mistress used to have. Might I ask where you got it, if I'm not being too bold?"
"What?" said Catherine.
She had not been paying attention. How was she to sneak out of the bed and then the room without Alice waking up?
"The dress, miss. Might I ask where you got it?"
Alice folded it neatly, then put it on the chair. Sister Margaret would no doubt come for it in the morning.
"Oh, I have no idea."
She briefly considered eating Alice, but she rather liked Alice, and the girl had been so helpful with the buttons.
"Alice."
"You did not."
"Catherine." "Oh, didn't I? I would have eaten Mrs. Raymond herself after that vegetable mess, although I'm pretty sure she would have been tough. I think one of the other girls gave it to me when I started on the streets. She didn't need it any more, and she told me it would be attractive to gentlemen. You know, make me look like a lady. They like us to look like ladies until they don't."
Catherine put her undergarments away in the drawer Alice pulled out for her, then put on her nightgown. She lay down and pulled the thin, rough wool blanket over her.
"You're too young to know about such things."
"The gentleman didn't think so," said Alice, getting into bed beside her.
"Ah, gentlemen. Best avoid them," said Catherine. "I haven't known a single one of them that didn't want to ruin a girl in one way or another. Good night."
The sky was darkening to dusk. Of course, they had not been issued candles. Such an extravagance would not have occurred to Mrs. Raymond or Sister Margaret. Catherine lay with her eyes closed. It would be several hours until she could sneak out of the room, through the long stone corridor, and down the stairs to Mrs. Raymond's office. There would be no light, but that would not bother her. A cat can see in the dark. She waited, motionless, like a cat that feigns sleep before a mouse hole. Slowly she heard Alice's breath slow, heard the sounds in the other rooms cease, except for gentle snoring. Slowly a half moon climbed the sky. There would be some light after all, but not too much. She didn't want anyone to see her. By moonlight she silently rose, careful not to wake Alice, and slipped out of the room. Through the window at the end of the hallway she could see the moon,
floating in the sky like a boat on the ocean. She passed the rooms of sleeping girls, then made her way down a flight of stairs to the second floor. Although she had been to Mrs. Raymond's office earlier that day, the stone hallways and wooden doors of the Magdalen Society looked so much alike that it was difficult to remember where it was located. Thank goodness Diana had described the building so thoroughly, even drawing her a map on a corner of Watson's paper. If Diana's instructions were to be trusted, Mrs. Raymond's office should be right at the end of this hall. Diana,
of course my instructions were to be trusted. I lived in that bloody house for 7 years. I should know where her office was. Sister Margaret caned me enough in it. Never Mrs. Raymond. It was always something she left to Sister Margaret. Until one day I turned on her and broke the cane. After that, she never did it again.
Catherine, I'm building suspense. If the reader isn't sure whether to trust you, it builds suspense, don't you see? Anyway, I wasn't sure whether to trust you then. Sometimes I'm not sure whether to trust you now. The office was exactly where Diana had described. It was not locked. Catherine pulled the door closed behind her and looked around. The brocade curtains had been drawn for the night. There was just enough light for her to avoid the armchairs, so much more comfortable than anything in the bare workroom, where girls sewed on wooden benches. She walked over thick carpet, soft under her bare feet, and welcome after the chill of the stone floors, to Mrs. Raymond's desk. Yes, the book was still there. She pulled open one of the curtains so moonlight would fall on the book. She opened it to the page where she had signed, then began to scan the list of names. Nothing. She turned back to the previous page. There, a name she recognized. Molly Keane. Several weeks ago she had entered the Magdalen Society. Why had she left? Catherine flipped back, page by page. And there were the others, scattered randomly among the list of names. Pauline Delacroix, Susanna Moore, Sally Jane Haywood, Anna Pettingill. More than a month ago, each of them. Even Pauline Delacroix, whom Holmes had not been able to trace, had been an inmate, that was the most appropriate word, of the Magdalen Society. What did it mean? There must be more information. Perhaps letters. In the desk? She was about to open the top drawer when she heard footsteps coming down the hallway. Three sets of footsteps. One sharp and decisive, one irregular, one shambling. Who could it be? But there was no time to speculate now. Where could she hide? Quickly she closed the book, moved it back to its place on the desk, and slipped into the window recess, drawing the curtain closed in front of her. The walls of the building were thick, the windows deeply set. There was plenty of space for her in the recess. The door opened, and the gas was lit. She could hear the striking of a match, and suddenly the curtains were edged with light. Catherine could not see them, but she could smell them. Two human, one a beast.
"I suggest that you moderate your tone with me," said Mrs. Raymond. "I allowed Diana to be taken because I was heartily sick of her, and because you owe me, Mr. Hyde. When should I expect to be paid for the information I'm providing?"
Hyde? This was Hyde? So he was alive after all. Mary had been wrong then.
"We have always been on good terms, Mrs. Raymond."
The voice was hoarse, almost a whisper, as though the speaker were consumptive. He spoke in the cultivated accent of a gentleman, but something about that voice sent a shiver up Catherine's spine. Mary.
Did it really? Or are you exaggerating for effect?
Catherine. It did. Really, there was something about his voice. It set my teeth on edge. But there was a kind of desperation in it that made me pity him, too.
"Good business terms," he continued. "My associate will pay you as soon as he can, I promise."
"I don't trust this associate of yours any more than I trust you," said Mrs. Raymond. "How am I to know he exists?"
12 girls I've provided. Descriptions, addresses. Twice I contacted the girls myself, luring them into places where you could collect what you desired.